Hello.
Well, it took you long enough.
I'm sorry.
Jeez, just keep me waiting. Can you hear me okay? I'm using my earphones.
Yes, I can.
Great. Do I sound really good?
I realized that I needed to put ice in my drink, and then I really
Why?
slowly did that.
You really slowly did that.
I
I'm
know.
over here like stripping, trying. I just got off the treadmill and I was like, I gotta be fast. I gotta be fast.
When
Come
is
to find out.
it so good and works out?
We know why I'm working. My other having a mental breakdown. So I'm gonna run a race now. The end. It might still happen. I mean, you don't know.
I
Stay
mean,
limb.
I probably need to do something to stop the mental breakdown that's coming.
And listeners, don't worry, it's not like any it's just the usual
It's
like
yeah.
life.
It's
There's no like thing that's happened that's
just
more
midterm.
lifey than the rest of the life.
It's that midterm part of the life. Like
Is.
the 40s and then midterms in the semester and
Yeah, I wasn't with you
everything.
with us last week. It was my fault this time.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't Christy's fault this time.
We
I was
co-care
so
brain. You had an anniversary.
She went to Colorado. Let's be honest. And we all know that Colorado trumps everything. Anyway, so I have vermouth. I had to borrow Campari from my neighbor because they didn't have it. The lady was really sad they didn't. I went to a different liquor store and this lady was like very helpful. And was just like very, was feeling what I was feeling about one, there not being a pre-mixed version of this drink, and then also like that she didn't have something. It made her really sad. Whereas like the other guy thought
Oh
he didn't
no,
really care.
he was
He was like,
letting
I'm here for the Coors Light or whatever. He was like, I don't get it. And then she was like, where are you going? I was like, I'm doing a podcast. And I thought for a minute she was gonna want to come with us. But then
She was like,
she didn't.
this sounds like a fantastic podcast. Yeah.
When it says one part, does that just mean a shot?
I did a shot of each.
Okay.
Guys, welcome to Theology on the Rocks, and
This looks gross.
we have
Sorry.
we
I'm
have
just sad about it.
a theme drink because we're going to talk about my author. And since she was in that lovely period of the Roaring Twenties, we decided to do something vermouth because apparently it was a big deal back then. And so we have Negronis, which I've never
Just
had
sounds
before.
Very boozy.
It is literally just booze. It's three shots.
It's three shots
There's
of
nothing
booze.
else in it.
And like I think there's supposed to be some version of like I'm guessing the red is fruit, hopefully of some persuasion. Like, is there any fruit in this? Is there a mixer in this?
There's no, it's just so yeah. Negroni is a shot of gin, a shot of
Got it.
vermouth, and a shot of Campari, which I don't know. It smells strong.
I'm taking a picture of myself beforehand so that I also look really sweaty
We can
since
have
I
the
just got
before
off.
and after.
Yeah, the before. I don't know. I look pretty crazy in the before. I actually want to send you the before. I'm just sending it to you right now, and you have to react in live term. Sam, you can't jump up here because this might kill you. Oh my gosh. Did you see my
Is the perfect before. I love it so much.
Oh, yeah, that's what it looked
Is.
like. That's me. Yeah, so we looked at my dissertation. Can we announce? Well, we looked at my dissertation last week. We're looking at hers this week, but also can we announce a happy
Yes,
thing?
we can. We
Well, I'll
finally.
let you do it. It's your story to tell.
Well, because we are talking about dissertations, you all get to read mine soon because it is getting published. So
Yee!
I'm so excited. This is like the bow, the wrapping up bow on the cap of doing this whole thing. And so it's going to be published with an imprint of Whip Finstock Pickwick, which is super exciting because a lot of the books I read are from that imprint. So
that's a great place.
I don't have a date as of yet. I have a date that I have to have it in by. And so we'll keep you all posted about when it's going to be available once I have that information. But yeah, I'm super excited. It was really exciting news. And then I got really paranoid because that's who I am. And so I kept making.
Well, she is a Denver Broncos fan.
We can't talk about it. It's so painful. And my neighbor keeps just, every time he sees me, he goes, Denver. And I'm just like, I am going to break into your house.
I always say it with like a sense of like fear. It's like, I don't know what you're going to do.
It's so bad. Oh, that game was so bad. I can't.
I know. Anyway. But that's the, not to take away from the book. That's a failure. This is not a failure.
This is not a failure. This is a very exciting thing. So like I said, we'll keep you all posted about information when we get information.
Have you thought about what your sexy title is going to be? Because it can't be the colon title that you have now.
I have not, because I didn't even type secret. I'm very bad at titles. And I did not title my dissertation. My supervisor did.
Truly, probably alongside the like dedication is probably the least important for a dissertation. I don't really.
I look at it
and I'm like, I don't remember coming up with that.
She didn't like any of the suggestions I had. So she was just like,
that is not shocking.
Not shocking at all.
Christy's supervisor, I worked with her for about 6 years, 7 years. And then Christy had her as a supervisor. She's lovely. Mm-hmm. We've talked about her a bunch. Heather Walton, but yeah. Heather, she knows what she likes.
She does. She knows what she wants from you, and she's
been around long enough to be able to get it. Yeah, that's right.
So I just have a bit of editing to do and some reworking of a couple sections. So it's not the worst, but it's been really fun. And it's part of what inspired us to do this, to these two episodes, is because I've been rereading mine and
I kept reread
Leah. So I was like,
it was nice for me to revisit because I hadn't. It's funny because my supervisor said, like, write your dissertation. This was her advice: write your dissertation, get it published, and then you can write whatever you want. Like, that was not what you wanted to write. What's really funny is I spent 4 years researching theology of reconciliation, Northern Ireland, conflict zones, etc. I've never written about it again.
Yeah. I mean,
which is crazy. Like,
it's so strange. I feel like
it's probably like a building block to what I've written. It certainly is a building block, but I don't know that there's nothing that's like directly related.
No. Well, I mean, I think that you can see the inspiration for your other work in yours for sure. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
it connects. But it's funny because I had so many friends who were finishing up their PhDs right when I started, and they all so incredibly despised their dissertations by the end that I was like, I don't want to care about this too much. Like, I think it's important to have a healthy distance between me and my PhD because I just want to do whatever gets me the degree. I don't want to get too like angsty about making it my masterpiece or something. And so I had, I don't know, kind of standoffish relationship with it for a while. And by the end I was like, this is my precious baby.
I had a really interesting, you talk about that and I was reflecting as you spoke, because I haven't really thought about it, like where I was at the end. I mean, I was a nervous wreck, but like, I think other than those emotions, like an imposter syndrome and all that, I think I I actually, at the end, had come to sort of dislike the word reconciliation, and I had to write it 8,000 times.
That makes, yeah.
And I actually didn't really, I believed very much in what I had created, like that chart that I talked about last week. But I didn't feel like it could ever be balanced. And so I felt like I had basically said, we're all screwed. And like, I kind of believed that. And then at the time I did, I have a little peppier attitude about, well, as I write bad theology, but I think, yeah, I mean, I think reading your dissertation again, actually, we're going to talk about that, gave me a lot of sort of, it helped me, I think literature is what, well, I'll expand it to arts. I think yeah. arts is what I was missing in my dissertation, but also in the books that I've written, because mm-hmm. I think it was a lot of human. It was a lot of sociology and not a lot of humans being creative. And yeah. I think that can pull you out of the hole.
Sometimes. It can sometimes, yeah. Like, I think too, sometimes.
It can drag you farther down.
For sure. and Jean Rhys really knows how to drag you to the pit, so.
Yeah. I know. I was reading Christie's stuff, and I was like, look, girl, I was like, you got the literature degree. When I get to this part, I'm just going to, like, read it for my own fun, because I don't know if what you're saying is right or not.
Leo was so kind as to help me toward the end, prepping for my Viva, and
oh gosh, just there's no greater karma than
general helping people do that. Help with the angst and the imposter syndrome and just the absolute, like, the spirals that you have at the end of your PhD,
which so- I had. It's so funny. She turned her dissertation. And I turned my book in, and I had her read my book, because, again, as I said, karma, yep. Yep. If you're in this world, it will come back again.
It will.
And I said, Christy, this doesn't mean anything. These words don't mean anything. I keep in mind, I supervised PhDs at this stage. I was a seasoned person. I was just like, none of these words are making sense.
I know. Have you tried this drink yet, by the way?
I'm not. Let's do it. Okay, it's here. So weird. My point, mine's a weird red from what I remember it's my first one being.
Yeah, it's a weird brownish red. Anyway, cheers. Let's see. Oh.
Oh my God. Oh, my heart. That hurt my heart. Oh. Oh. Oh, I hate it. Oh, I hate it so much.
Gross. Oh, I hate it. So, you know what I hate, though?
Oh, gosh.
Oh, that's terrible.
But it's the, yes, it's.
It's the compartment. It's that.
Maybe I got some bad.
No.
Oh, my gosh.
Mine is brand new, and it is gross. It is so yucky.
Mine came in a little shot glass from my neighbor.
Oh, gosh. Oh. Terrible, you guys. Don't drink Negronis.
Okay, I had been led astray, and Christy was with me because, and I'm going to name drop.
You have to
someone.
Name drop this one.
I have to, because I know Lynn Tonstad at Yale, who does queer theology and et cetera, amongst other brilliant things, and through some of my friends, that sort of network thing. Anyway, so we were at the Scottish reception for AER, and she had to leave like very early the next morning, and she'd only done like a carry-on or something, and she had this mixed Negroni in her hand.
Negroni.
She did. Bottle. And she said, I think it was, Leah, you'll want this.
She just gave it to you. Like, we were standing there, and she was just like, here, you can take this. And
I did. And so, but I put it in my check suitcase and didn't think about it for a while.
Yeah.
Beethoven, do you need some of this drink?
Beethoven, would you like hide some? His fans. He knows.
Beethoven. He knows we're going to make him famous following. One day. Oh, what a nightmare. We all can have him. If the fan club ever wants to adopt, like, just not forever, maybe just like a year or so, just for my couches to heal. But anyway, so I had it later, and it would proceed. it being the only one I've ever had, it did not taste like this. This tastes so gross. Crazy.
This is so gross. I don't know what to do about this.
Well, I don't know what to do because I bought, well, I'm glad I didn't buy the
I know fruit I punch don't own a part bottle of this nastiness. What am I going to do with it? Oh, this is terrible.
Is there any other thing that vermouth does?
Yes. And because like I said, we wanted to do something with vermouth. So I had looked up a variety of vermouth drinks, and you can just drink vermouth on the rocks, which.
Oh, I also don't have ice in mine, which is, ooh, I'll put ice in it.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's not helping mine, but
it's not gonna hurt anything. I think I can go away from my phone. Hopefully we'll see. I have my ear thing.
Do you like Aperol spritzes?
I don't know. Maybe. Probably. It's got alcohol in it. Maybe.
I mean, it's reminding me of Aperol spritzes. It's that same, like, there's a bitter aftertaste that you get. And, like, I really love the idea of Aperol spritzes, but when I drink them, it makes me angry because of the aftertaste.
Stuart, can you drink this? Sorry, Salem. I just killed my cat. I just want you to take a sip of this. Just drink it. You don't even know what it is.
Just
Negroni?
It's not Negroni, no. He's looking at me like he knows I'm lying.
You're like, no, it's not.
He was like, you're lying. This is what 10 years ago. You didn't tell me what you thought about it. He turned and walked away. He didn't. He took one sip. I said it was Negroni. He said you're lying. And then he walked away. My husband is a man of few words, but that was exceptionally few. He just walked away.
It's so gross. It's this like bitter aftertaste. I hate it. Oh my god.
What do we do? What do we do with
it? I'm gonna finish it because I can't not finish it, but
well, how about you tell us why you picked it though? Because that part is important.
Yeah, okay.
If you can talk, because I'm gonna try to take a sip with these ice cubes.
We're gonna work our way through this one. Hey, on a scale of 0 to the redneck martini, where does this one rate?
I think this is worse than the redneck martini, Christy. I'm sorry.
It is worse.
It needs a mixer. Like, it doesn't have a mixer.
It needs literally anything in it. Well, so the vermouth part was the
important. It is that aftertaste. Is that the vermouth, the aftertaste?
No, it's the Campari, I think. And
it's like a baby's diaper got into my throat and lips.
I didn't feel like either of us were really ready for just vermouth on the rocks because neither of us have ever had vermouth before. And then you had liked that Negroni, so I was like, we'll just do that.
Well, I did.
Now I have only regret, but my dissertation, like you said, had the literature part in it. Which I focused on an author named Jean Reese, who very few people actually know. She has one book that was more popular, White Sargasso Sea, which is the book that was like a kind of take on Bertha, who is Rochester's wife in Jane Eyre that he locks in the attic. And so now, mind you, you know, Jane Eyre was written in the 1800s, some point. I should know that, but I don't remember.
You could tell me any, I told you this is not, you could tell me anything. I'd be like, okay.
I just can hear all of my literature friends being like, how can you possibly forget this? But, Jean Reese wrote White Sargasso Sea in the 1960s. So obviously it's her take on what she thought of Bertha and Bertha's story. And it became very popular because it was kind of swept up into the whole second wave feminist movement and things like that. But Jean Reese actually super hated that whole level of popularity. She didn't really like being a kind of token feminist author.
That must be terrible.
And
to sell books and be popular.
Well, and two, it's kind of funny because it was like her only book that was super popular. So her other books, which are the ones that I actually wrote about in my thesis, she wrote during the interwar period, so the same time as Fitzgerald and Hemingway. And she also lived in Paris at that time and knew a bunch of them. And she also hated them because they were mean to her. She felt like...
She sounds like a nightmare, kind of.
Absolutely is a nightmare of a human. I mean, like, there's a lot of good things to be said about some of the stuff she wrote, but, like, she was not... Heather one time asked me, do you want to get drinks with her? And I said, I do want to get drinks with her only because I kind of want to witness the shit show. But not because I want to be friends with her, because she was...
This feels like a... Yeah, she's the problem.
She is the problem. And she was, you know...
Is there any background on why she's the problem?
Oh, so much background. Just... Yeah. She was an alcoholic, and she had a whole lot going on in her life that, again, I will kind of... update you all on in a second here, but like generally she was angry at the world, and she didn't really feel like she deserved redemption. She didn't really want to be included in the groups anymore, but she was also really mad that she wasn't included in the groups. So she was just really complicated. But so were her books, which is what is kind of the point of using them.
I have a lot of questions about this,
but she was
takes my pessimism a little bit too far. I think
she absolutely she does. She was born in the Caribbean. She was born in Dominica, and her father was a fairly well-off man. He was Welsh, her family was white, and she was kind of part of the white class that was in Dominica at the time. And she became kind of problematically obsessed with Black people. Really felt like she wanted to become a Black person because she thought they were happier. Yeah, it's a bit weird.
She thought they were what?
Superior? She thought they were happier.
Happier. Okay.
Yeah, she thought they were happier. She had a pretty miserable childhood. She felt really outside of her own family. She thought that Black people, because they were simpler, basically, and a good kind of jealousy. It was that kind of racist, I just assumed. Mm-hmm. But her, and her mother didn't get along very well, and she ends up going to England to live with her aunt, supposedly to go to school. But she couldn't get rid of her kind of Caribbean accent. And she drops out of school to become a dancer. And
as you do?
As you
what do. What persuasion? like a ballet dancer? Yeah, a flamingo dancer?
Like in the traveling shows that would happen. Not quite like... Not a great career, really. And most of the time, this was like the first step to becoming some kind of an actress or something like that. But again, she couldn't get rid of her accent, and people really made fun of her for it. So she ends up becoming a kind of pseudo sex worker because she couldn't make money. Her father had died. Her mother refused to send her any more money. Her aunt.
This is maybe crass, but what is a pseudo sex worker?
Well,
escort, or
kind of. Like, it's kind of more like she would have boyfriends that would then start funding her life. You know, these aren't like healthy.
They're not relationships.
Kind of relationships. This is like she would find a rich man. She was like a sugar baby.
Did you hear me sound like a snake, for instance? I was about to say sugar daddy.
Yeah,
that's not a. Okay, I didn't want to take her down to that level.
She did get married a couple of times. I think a total of 3 times in her life, if I'm remembering correctly. But God, this drink is terrible. Maybe this is why she was so angry all the time. She's drinking terrible drinks.
I don't know what part hurts me the most, but I really hate it.
It's really bad. So really not a nice life. She was also sexually assaulted when she was a kid.
Oh my gosh.
Dad's friend. I know. Really terrible life. So like we can understand a lot of the reasons why she ends up being the way that she is. But also, you know, she's not really helping herself as an adult either. When she was married the first time, she was in Europe, and she ends up kind of becoming part of that expatriate artist circle that was going around, mm-hmm. especially in Paris. And she ends up in this kind of love affair thing with another author named Ford Madox Ford, which is a question I have. Why do people have the same first and last names for periods of time? Like Ford Madox Ford, why?
I was going to ask, did you think of a name of a more boring white guy? But, you know, that's fine too.
So obviously this breaks up her first marriage. She has a child at one point. I'm trying to remember, this is kind of in the recesses of my brain.
Oh. She has
a child at one point that dies, but she did have a child that lived as well, but didn't have a great relationship with her kid.
Shocked. Color me stunned. Color me stunned.
All of this is very shocking. After a little while, she had written 4 books and a bunch of short stories, but again, hadn't found really any success. She wasn't included. Hemingway and Fitzgerald didn't like take her out on the town with them.
Hemingway was like, give me my frozen drink. I'm headed to Cuba. Goodbye.
Women suck. And Fitzgerald was just way too drunk and probably distracted by Zelda. So
I think they both were probably way too drunk.
So she ends up kind of being in hiding in England. Everyone thinks that she's died. And then an actress wanted to make a movie out of one of her books.
Can I just stop you right here?
Yes.
Who was she hiding from? Why was she hiding?
She wasn't really like purposely hiding. She had kind of become obscure. Nobody knew who she was.
I guess based like in the 30s and 20s, like you could just.
This would have been like
just go away.
40s and 50s. Yeah.
She's
broke. She's still basically trying to be a sugar baby, except that she's not young anymore, so it's harder. And
it is.
Her third husband would die maybe at this point. Again, all of this I knew at one point. I had to write it all down. But there are a couple of autobiographies you can read if you're interested. She's a fascinating character.
So, yeah. She sounds...
She gets rediscovered by this artist who wanted to make a movie out of her book. And, like, literally, people thought she was dead. So, at some point, she had to, like, prove that she was herself because they would sign off on the copyright for her book. They were like,
that's amazing.
Who you are. You are who you are. So this is after she gets discovered again is when she writes White Sargasso Sea, becomes wildly popular. Like I said, everybody wants to talk to her. She's at this point just this fabulously crazy old white like drunk lady. And apparently interviews with her are like just the craziest things because half the time she's lying about stuff just to see if you would believe her. And she was just constantly like cracking jokes and stuff. And so just getting any kind of a serious interview is really difficult. But yeah, so that's the story of Jean Rhys.
Drink is starting to make more sense.
Again, just a lot of drinking, but her first 4 novels, the 4 interwar novels that she wrote, really have quite a bit of some of those pieces of her in it. So like one story also includes that the girl is from, had been born and raised in the Caribbean and then moved to England and can't like fit in England. And all of them are these pseudo sex worker types, you know, basically just going from rich boyfriend to rich boyfriend to make their money. And they all feel extremely excluded. Some of her like life experiences are included in it. Like one of them loses a baby, stuff like that. So there's a bit of her own self put into them, but she was also, she was a more meticulous writer than Heather Walton. She was like obsessive about editing and reworking her stuff. She made sure every word was perfect. So it'd take her ages to write stuff. And you could go through all of her journals and stuff and kind of see the progression from her writing down stuff that had happened to her to what it becomes in the book. And realize that like these aren't just stories about her life. She's really worked out a lot of like meaning and depth to it. So because the world is misogynistic, though, a lot of people talk about her writing as this kind of autobiographical stuff. Like, oh, it's just her telling stories about her life. But just
like, as opposed to like Hemingway.
I know,
like,
right? Men do
straight doing that.
And we just don't say it. Like,
it's, right. It's like I learned about him in American Lit. And I mean, it's just all like.
It's just all his stuff.
His life.
Yeah. I was in war.
I went to Cuba. Here's a little talking about that.
Her writing is beautiful. The books are pretty short. They're, you know, not super long tomes or anything, but they're incredibly dark. None of them have a happy ending. A couple of the women definitely die. Sometimes you're not sure if the woman is dead or not. There's a kind of back alley abortion in one of them, she was really writing in a lot of clearly explicit sex scenes and then a few sexual assault scenes as well. And so a lot of these books were like also deemed wildly inappropriate for the 20s and 30s. People were like, oh my goodness.
Do you think that they're explicit because she's writing from her experience?
I do. I think that especially in the scenes where you get more of that explicitness, you can tell that this is coming from that kind of place, you know.
Even the abortion one?
Yeah, the abortion one is it's pretty vague, and some people I mean, I think you're pretty sure that's what's happening, but what happens with the abortion scene, she's not clear. And this is one of the ones.
Trigger warning for those.
Yes. Sorry. All of this is a trigger warning.
Yeah. Sorry.
All of this is terrible.
I'll put up something in the description. Yeah. Like when we talk about Jean Reese, it's got all the warnings.
It's got so all of the warnings. It was a rough few years reading her stuff. I had to like take quite a few breaks because it was, you would just get so depressed, you know. This is the scene is where it's not sure if he died or not. Like people go back and forth. And then there's another one where, again, they're not sure if she died or if somebody killed her. There's a lot of that. But again, all of them end just terribly. Like
not a single happy ending in the midst of
not
it?
Not a single happy ending. You're just constantly feeling, and there's a mixture of feeling like, I want to help these women because they clearly can't help themselves. And then you get kind of mad because you're like, why can't you help yourself? One of the women in the book is fluent in French and she knows this, but then she gets a job and her boss doesn't speak French. And he tells her to do something in French, but he doesn't speak French well. So what he tells her is wrong. And she just, because she has such a bad self-esteem, she just assumes that she doesn't understand what he's trying to tell her, but she's too embarrassed to ask, so she ends up messing up the assignment and gets fired. And it's like, you didn't mess up, he couldn't speak French, but these women are so broken that they can't even stand up for themselves in these like fairly simple ways of saying, like that sentence didn't make any sense, or, you know, can you translate that for me or something?
And it's funny then that she doesn't want to be a feminist person.
Yeah,
I think she's known, but then she's writing very much seems like from the at least the female perspective pretty heavily.
Absolutely.
But she maybe doesn't want to be a part of the scene or whatever.
I think she just didn't want to have labels. I think she was very uncomfortable with being placed on any kind of a, like, here's what you are. There's a few quotes from her at one point. She says, how can you even describe me? I'm not even English. Because she is, like, by citizenship and all of that, she's English. Her father was Welsh, but she grew up in Dominica. And so she doesn't feel like she actually has a nationality. And it's this kind of self-identity problem, I think, that plays a part in why she doesn't want these labels that people would give her. And she definitely has quite a lot.
She's so woke.
She has a lot of difficulties, but she actually, I mean, in terms of more intersectional feminism, she fits in much better because her concerns are usually not just like gendered, but instead she talks a lot about class and economics, and she's talking a lot about nationality and the different ways that we judge people based on where they're from. She's deeply concerned about the kinds of like multi-layered ways that people get shoved to the side. And so it's a really progressive work for her, for her time for sure. But I think even for her, I don't know that she would have been able to really put into words all of the things that she was doing, except that she just understood that all of this stuff was why she had such a rotten life.
I have questions for you about your dissertation, but you're kind of answering them as we go. So.
Oh,
I mean, I did have the question of why you picked Jean Rhys, but that was in the middle of my questions. But like, also maybe how did you come upon her? Was that in your lit degree or?
Yeah, actually, Heather introduced her to me.
Because I'd never heard of her until I read your stuff.
Yeah, I had read White Sargasso Sea in my lit degree and my lit bachelor's degree. I knew about that book, but I hadn't ever heard of her other stuff. And so what I approached Heather with was that I really wanted to talk about how to understand the concept of the image of God when people suck. And without kind of having a perfection of it. I felt like a lot of times, so I was really fascinated when I learned in seminary about all the different theories of the image of God, like the idea that it's a substance within us, or that it's our relationships with God or with people, or the kind of functional image of God, saying that it's how we operate and that we're imaging God by doing God's work in the world and stuff. But all of it felt like, yeah, but if your life sucks, or if you are a sucky person, or if you just aren't very like confident or whatever, like there's a variety of different ways that you can feel like you're excluded from this conversation, because they all require you to think about like the greatness of God, which is an understandable thing. Of course, that's what we're going to go to, you know? But I was just like, people have hard lives. And every time we would study one of these theories, there would always be these questions that came up about like, what do we do with people that don't fit these parameters?
Like practical questions?
Because
you're doing almost practical theology?
Almost.
Like when people suck, you had the image of God, I was with you, but then you said when people suck, and all of a sudden we were back here on earth again.
I remember when we were talking about horror movies a bit, like a couple episodes ago, and I mentioned that paper that I had seen at the regional AAR, he talked about this, the idea that these horror movie monsters don't fit into this image of God. And so like, do they not have it? Did they lose it? Like that kind of question. And so I was just really intrigued by that. And I thought, you know, you have to come up with an idea.
Oh, it, yeah, you do.
And it's so hard.
Well, that was my first question, actually. And I don't want to interrupt you, but like, I have circled in like many circles, despite having read this before, is that you have a complex setup.
It is a complex setup, I think, because
go ahead.
I didn't know what I was doing.
Guys, anyone who wants to do their PhD in the UK, you got to know. You got to, it's really like the, we would call it grounded theory. Like you have to do it up from the ground.
Yeah.
Like it's, you don't get the classes.
You don't get you the really classes. Have to and I didn't come up get with the it. Classes. And I was so glad I didn't have to take the classes. But at the same time, like,
they could have been helpful.
It could have been helpful. I don't know. There are so many versions of this PhD, and there are so many versions of Heather would just have me write papers. Like I have just paper, like I was in classes with her. I have all these papers of how I understood these various books, Jean Rhys, it's all like different theories and stuff. Cause she was just trying to like guide me toward an answer. And it was a very long and windy road, which is how I live my life, is a long and windy
road. I mean, it's not complex in the sense that it doesn't, I have different words for things that are convoluted and don't make sense. Complex is a nice word because it's saying that you've done a lot of things and it does make sense.
Yeah. Well, is... I think because, you know, I had to work it out first, but I had to work it out in all these different papers. And then finally, when I got to write the dissertation, the stuff that's there, I had already done all of that work out. But I also was very acutely aware of how hard it was to do that work. You know,
because you start off with systematics and then you move into kind of what I would say is practical.
Yeah.
And then you talk about Jean Rhys and then you talk about trauma. I mean, these are, but you connect it. And I think that was when I was reading it the first time. I think the thing I kept saying is just make sure it's all connected because it is, but make sure that like a dummy reading it.
Yeah. You really have to go through when you're writing your thesis, you really have to go through and just constantly say things that you think are obvious, which is so frustrating, but you have to literally put sentences in there. Like I am now doing this thing.
So one of the questions that I had was which, you have the, what I would call the holy pantheon. Oh God, this drink is killing me. Pantheon of systematicians. But I want you to pick one who you found to be the most helpful. And I'm going to take out anyone who is alive now.
So but that eliminates Jürgen Moltmann, and I think that's rude.
Kathy Tanner, I know. You've got a lot of people. I know. I read it. I remember. She's in my book too.
Leah all and I props. Like the joke that literally everyone is included in both of our theses. Truly this is a fact. So I start out talking about Bart and Tillich.
You can only pick one.
And
who's going on your island with you?
And then
you and Jean Rhys.
The early feminist theologians like Valerie Sabing and Mary Daly. I mean, and I, it, this is with like an asterisk, but Karl Barth is
no,
it's Karl
Barth. Of course, it's always
Karl. I'm sorry.
It's fine. I don't care. I mean, you're definitely not the first one.
he did become quite a thread throughout it. You know, he connects me because I work through those. And then I turned to Black theology because if you want to study trauma in any kind of way, you really need to read Black theology because they do incredible work with that. But like Bart inspires James Cone. Bart inspires Katie Geneva Cannon. Bart inspires.
Who I also just Kathy realized Kenner. Passed away.
Yes, Cannon passed away.
I know, and I know in my head, but like It still hurts my soul.
It still hurts. I know. I attended her memorial service at AAR the year she passed, which was a really beautiful service. But yeah, I mean, he shows up in everybody's work. So,
okay,
you know, you have to.
Yul Bartman.
I remember other people asking me why he was there. And I was like, I think because you have to. I think it's a requirement.
I mean, that's why I jokingly put him in my first year.
But he is helpful. I think he kind of sets the stage. Because, you know, Bart, like you, Bart really kind of promotes the idea of contextual theology and recognizing your context in order to do theology. And I think that was helpful for working through those. But yeah, I think the one thing that he gives to the thesis that I really took was that part of understanding the image of God was this idea of really seeing each other. And he talks about it more vaguely, but then there's another theologian, Lisa Stevenson, who talks about it more specifically. And she says that in order to image God, you have to look the person or God in the eye, and you have to like see who they actually are and not who you want them to be. And that's what I had to do with Reese's characters, because there were so many things I wanted from them, and there were so many things I wanted from Reese. Like, I wanted her to have like gotten her stuff together and like have a happier ending where people were like interviewing her and she was like, oh yes, in my wild days, but I'm tamed now, or something, you know.
What was her ending? Because see, I don't know.
I mean she
died of like alcoholism.
She died. She was not terribly young when she lived a good while, but she died not super wealthy, kind of known, but not to the level I think that she might have wanted to be known.
Do you think that changed from her being sort of a stubborn revolutionary and not wanting a label to, by the end, she kind of wanted to be known, do you think? Or do you think she kept that throughout?
I think she kept that throughout. I think maybe in the beginning she wanted more to be known. I think it, like in her time with Ford Madox Ford, part of the issue was that he was
Lord Madox.
Ford Madox Ford was really famous and well-known author, and she,
okay, because I really want to put up a picture of him because I have a vision in my head and I want to know if match
it. He looks what you, he's, I mean, he's, yeah, that's,
does he have right. a beard?
Please. He was really well-known, and she felt like this secondary, and like, I'm just here to tell you, I don't know any of his work. Like, he didn't stand the test of time. So,
but he was a lord.
But he was, yeah, he was the guy, and he was famous, and she was mad about that. But I think by the end, she'd kind of been like, well, I'm never going to get the recognition I wanted, so I'm not going to take any of it. But she was, you know, she was this idea of like what happens when there's a lot of trauma and you don't really heal from it, and you don't get better. And so that's really what the focus was for the end part of my thesis, was how to understand.
Yeah. I was going to say, I wanted to say, like, you set it up like sort of in the way that I did, which is doing your sort of systematic stuff first, some of the practical stuff, which one of my questions is, do you think liberation theology is practical theology, which is the whole thing. we wrestle with that too. Don't worry.
Yeah.
And because we don't want to be the thing that they hate. And then you have the genery stuff, and then you have the trauma stuff. You got so much information, like
so much information.
But you do, but like in a, I will say in a very, like, very like mastery way, like this is not just like, yeah, no, it's not just you throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks. Like, you're talking about, one, all the right people, which when we do a dissertation, we know that's right. Like, you talk about trauma, you talk about, like, Shelley Rambo and all those people. That's right. But also, like, you sort of get it and you weave this and make the connection. And then also about this connection between, I do have questions about, which we can talk about this at the end, because I do want to hit on the trauma bit. I don't think we've hit on that bit too much, because I actually have this comment, and this is my practical theologian. So I apologize.
I'm ready for it.
But it's like, so I said, okay, trauma. These are how my notes go. I'm like a sassy asshole when I write notes. Okay, trauma. What role does God play or not play in trauma? And what does either of those positions, if we take those, say about God as God's self?
Yeah, I think, goodness, that...
And then different theologians, of course, have different ideas about this. So I'm not asking you to, like, tell me definitively.
To tell you definitively.
But, I mean, what were the people saying that you studied, or what conclusion did you come to?
Yeah, one of the things that I talk about a bit in the trauma section is the idea that God is also traumatized, and that God's risk in creating the world introduces trauma to God's self as well. And so when we're looking at, for instance, Shelley Rambo talks about Thomas and Jesus in the, after Jesus is resurrected, and Thomas is like, is it really you? And then Jesus like has him see his, oh goodness, sorry.
Oh, I was like, all my friends are here. My other friend is outside with my dog.
It can't
be that those are the only two people that call me.
the only person who calls me is my mom. So
that's fair. My mom is also a rogue one on time.
She also has impeccable timing. Always. I'm always like, not this moment, mom.
Kathy.
The Kathy. Yeah, so she's talking about Thomas like touching Jesus's wounds, and how we've framed this into this Thomas has failed because he doubted, and how terrible of Thomas, he should have just believed. But like that's not what you see Jesus doing. And Jesus is just saying like, oh yeah, here are my wounds, like you can touch them. And she talks about God inviting us into God's trauma through this scene, and that what we understand about trauma is actually that this is an incredibly bonding period for us and God, because we all experience this trauma. I think that's a really radical understanding of God and trauma, because we don't really like to talk about God being wounded or being traumatized.
I was going to say, that's not a very Bardian view.
It's not a very Bardian view. Bart would not love that idea.
He'd be like, Jesus, though.
Jesus was literally killed, Bart.
And Jesus is God, right, Bart? Right?
Do you see the connections here, sir? but yeah, it's a very kind of, I think, beautiful thing, and something that we see in a lot of other, I think Emil Brunner, who I only kind of very briefly talk about at the very end, but Brunner, who famously, him and Bart hated each other, and like would apparently were,
if only I could have been Bart's enemy in real life.
Would like yell at each other across the street or something. I've heard stories.
That'd be amazing. Anyway. I just want to be at New College in Edinburgh and him come in and me just be like, no! Night! What did he say? Night!
Night!
Thou shalt not pass! He'd be like, I built this place, bitch. What are you talking about?
But Brunner talks about the image of God in this idea of relationship, and he says that the reason that we understand any of this about God is because God decided to create the world, and like God invites all of this. He invites the relationship, he invites the risk that is taken, you know, like God is making the decision not to just live in this kind of perfect God self, but actually invites in the drama.
But in some ways you think like, if God's omniscient and God knows, if you buy into that, then God must know what trauma does to humans. If God is able to prevent it, why wouldn't God
prevent it? I mean, I think that brings up a lot of questions about God that I purposely don't try to answer.
You are a systematician,
I know, but I mean, in part,
no, you can't know. It's just the things that were coming into my gen-addled brain.
Our students are always like, "Yeah, but what about this?" And it's like, "Well, those are fair questions. I think they're actually important too." But I think
Aquinas did it the best because he was just like, it's all a mystery.
It is all a mystery.
It's just all a mystery.
It's a mystery about, like, what do we even mean by, like, omnipotent? Like, how powerful is all powerful? Mm-hmm. Because it's not just, like, God can do anything, no matter how irrational or unreasonable.
Or maybe so. We don't know.
Well, we can assume that because we wouldn't say things like God can destroy God's self, you know, we don't, there's certain things we would assume God either doesn't do or can't do, and so there's already some amount of limit to that, but like then we get angsty about like, oh, but God's omnipotent. I just think that there's a lot less omnipotence than we tend to think there is. We want God to be like, I don't know, some kind of mega superhero. But the superheroes are always destroying things, so they're not actually great, you know? Do you remember that superhero movie that Will Smith did? I can't remember what it was called, but he was like a terrible superhero and he was constantly getting arrested because he'd like...
Oh yeah, he was drunk. Like, I think it was Charlize Theron that was
in it. Yeah, Charlize Theron was in it. It had a terrible ending, but like the beginning part where it was just like this drunk superhero is like constantly accidentally like smashing into buildings and causing all this destruction and people are like, stop. I always thought it was like, I was like,
I just remember him falling off of a building and crashing into like the road.
I just remember
that's the only scene I have in mind.
Time I've seen a realistic understanding of these superheroes, because it's always so destructive. They're constantly like leveling New York City, and then they're just like, oh, but we saved the world. It's okay.
I mean, you are preaching to the wrong congregation on this one. Because I agree with you. Now, if you want to go talk to Stuart, who has not walked back from walking away.
I know.
May have been the end of us. Thanks.
We're about to go to this Star Wars themed theology beer camp, so I might be making enemies prior to getting there, but sorry, I just
have to help you. I found this is we're gonna come back to these, but I found the song I'm gonna sing at karaoke, and it's a country song and not the one I sent you last, but another one.
I want it to be the one that sent me last.
I know, but we can't do that because I couldn't do it. Oh God!
Anyway,
I know.
Your camp, it's gonna be jolly.
Anyway, I'm gonna. This drink is so stupid for me to go over your dissertation. Can you imagine if I was an examiner right now? I'd just be like, bah, trauma, blah.
Trauma. But yeah, I mean,
I'm going to say, and maybe this is the PG part of me, but I don't think it is. I think it's more maybe I'm a closet Catholic. I don't know how much we can say about God. I think it's the practical theology person.
I
think we can say what people say about God, but I don't know. I think some of this, but I don't get, I think a lot of people get anxious. Like, I think part of the like Reformed tradition was like, we've got to know about God. And it was like,
I think we have to allow for a lot more mystery than we do. Because we think we know everything.
And, like, the knowing everything informs our rituals that makes us feel better about things like birth and dying and marriage and things.
This is true.
Oh, God. But this is the cynical part. See? I'm blaming Jean. I'm blaming Jen and Jean Reese for this.
Dear old Jean Reese.
Okay, I did have a final question.
Yes.
And you can talk and fill in any gaps. But my final question was, it seems like, and this could be me misreading it, that your conclusion talks about this idea of trauma that connects God and humanity. Like there, because you talked about this idea that God understands in a way because God has been traumatized.
Right.
Is there not any other way that God could connect? Well, okay. Actually, I'm going to rephrase that question. Do you think trauma has to be the vehicle of that connection? Or could it be... Trauma... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I don't know that trauma has to be, but I think that it is. And I don't think that it's the vehicle. I think it's a vehicle.
Okay. Because my next thing was, why can't it just be joy?
Why can't we just be happy?
Again, my sassy asshole comment was, why not just joy?
I think because I also agree with Catherine Tanner that part of our relationship with God is that God empowers humans and that that it's an empowering relationship. And I do think that that's true. And I think that even as all of this trauma is happening, that God is still trying to empower us. But I wish it was just joy.
And Me too.
I wish that those things were true, but they're just not. And I feel like it's better to just like look that crap in the eye and say, like, we're all traumatized by a variety of things. And even just witnessing trauma can be very traumatizing.
Yes.
And just knowing that we exist in this very traumatic world is traumatizing. But I think
that my husband had a very traumatizing thing that I won't go into, but last night, and he just kept saying, our lives are just so precarious. And I was like, oh my God.
So precarious.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, and two, to bring it up, like one of the motivators for my thesis was a lot of grief that I was experiencing right when I started, because my brother-in-law had a sudden fatal heart attack. Mm. And it was out of the blue. He had just had a doctor's appointment, seemingly healthy. And it just completely like reshaped our whole family. And so, yeah, there was a lot of very personal stuff of me like kind of crying out, like, why does it have to be trauma? But I think that that's part of why I arrived at this conclusion too, is that idea that yes, there is also joy and God is empowering, but that doesn't mean that God isn't also traumatized, and that part of our connection and our imaging of God is actually in those parts, so that we're not seeing those parts as the bad parts or the parts we were trying to erase. Or again, a lot of disability theory and theology talks a lot about kind of these ideas of thinking about, if we do go to heaven or get a resurrected body, is it going to be a perfected body, or is it going to be the body we actually had?
Yeah.
And those conversations, I think, are really important, because a lot of who we are is stuff that is because of those traumas. And I wouldn't be who I am today if trauma hadn't happened. It doesn't mean I wish obviously I wish that that trauma hadn't happened, but then I'd be a different person. So it's a complicated kind of feeling.
But it's also the world that we're set up in.
It is.
Because I think actually when I look at this question, and you answered that very beautifully actually, is when I look at that, I'm like, but life isn't just joy.
Yeah.
Like life is a lot. And actually joy is sometimes quite hard to find. Joy so is. In some ways our lives are a lot more about the sort of trauma and just day-to-day humbug of existence. And in some ways you have to think, like, if that's the world that was created, there has to be some connection to God in that, because God created the world, if we buy into that. And if God can't connect to that, then
is God even really
connected? What is the that's right what's the yeah. Well, then to me, what's the point of God? Like, if God can't at least understand my fear when I get on an airplane, right. And I pray harder than I've ever prayed in my entire life. And I'm usually several lines deep, and I'm just like,
I'm never more Calvinist than when I'm on an airplane.
I am never more, I guess, evangelical than when I'm on an airplane, because I'm like, I just want to go to heaven if it crashes, please. You know, and then I'm like, telling my students, I don't know if hell's actually in the Bible, but then I get on a plane, I'm like, everything's out of the window, literally.
I like to envision that God suddenly magically has a hand, and that God is just like literally holding my plane as it flies through the air.
Aww, I love that. Beethoven agrees.
I also know that I have to take prescribed medication to get on planes, so.
I wasn't going to say anything, but I also would do that if I didn't also think I needed to drink, and then I'd just be dead, probably. It was funny. I picked Christy up from Charlotte Airport. She was coming to see me, and she was just sort of like, she wasn't anything crazy. She just was like dead inside.
I was dead.
And I was like, she was. And that's what you're supposed to be when you take this medication. And she goes, if I just get a Starbucks, I'll be fine.
So I'm fine.
You were 100% fine.
You legit drank
that Starbucks, and it was like your life had just turned around. And I was like, huh, okay.
It's so great because these medicines that we had to work through a lot of medicine to find the one that worked for me, but this one just makes me not care at all.
I was like, Christy, I'm so glad you came to visit me. And she was like, yo, hi. And then she just looked at me, and like, you could tell her like soul. When you meet Christy, she's like way nicer than me and like very vivacious. And so I was like, okay. And then she looked at me, and you could tell that little spark was trying to come through. She was like, if you can just get me to Starbucks.
If you can get me a Starbucks, we'll have a soul again.
I'll be a human again. And I was like, there's one right. I think I just pointed because I think there was one like was literally, one right
we literally
across
the baggage claim, got me a coffee, and that was great. But no, one time I was flying across the ocean, as you and I did a lot. There was some turbulence, and I remember thinking very clearly, this plane is going to crash and I'm going to die. But I thought it in that exact amount of emotion. Like, this is it. I'm going to die now. Like, that was the most I could muster up emotion-wise. And I just went back to watching the movie.
I mean, look, drugs help. They get us to places that we need to go. And take the meds. If they make you...
Take the meds.
If they figure you out, and if they don't do drugs, kids. Yeah. But if they do, then do them. Yeah. And but I think that comes full circle in some ways too, Jean Reese, because I'm going to tie this up with a bow because that's how I like it. Roll.
Yeah.
But it's like she, in some ways, we talked so much about her at the beginning of the podcast, but I do think, oh my God, this drink's going to kill me. Christy, I swear to God.
I'm almost done.
I swear to God, whatever God's up there, I swear. Whether this is literally my torture, right now, my trauma right now.
This drink is.
And he's going to be.
I've never hated a drink more than I've hated this drink.
I have done it slow, but it was still effective because I'm talking fast. Anyway, but. I like that Jean Reese was like, I don't want to be made into some sort of like commodity or like mm-hmm. put on a pedestal or anything like this, because actually in some ways I think she was trying to represent like that whole idea that like I am not going to even think about the fact that you want our lives to be about joy because that's not what they're, you know?
Yeah.
And that I am going to reflect the day-to-day life. Because I'm guessing sometimes in her novels, there's maybe a hint of happiness.
Oh, for sure. There are little hints of happiness here and there.
And for some people, that's maybe what life is like.
Her short stories are a little bit more optimistic. There's a short story series that she did called... Oh no, it's left my, I can see the book in my head.
Oh gosh.
Read the title.
That's called it. That's
it's something called
the Negroni.
Something about a tiger. Anyway, okay. But it's a series of short stories, and the way they work through, it's almost like you're reading a book, because it works like kind of along a story path. But the last story in this series is only about 2 pages long, and it's called I Used to Live Here Once. And the story before it was Sleep It Off Lady. That's the title. It's Sleep It Off Lady, of the whole thing. There's no tiger.
Oh gosh. Okay. Anyway. Did you look it up?
No, I just remembered it. It just
Oh, amazing. Back. I love it when that happens.
But Sleep It Off Lady is this older lady who's an alcoholic, and she ends up dying on the sidewalk outside of her house because nobody will help her because they're like, oh, you're this old drunk lady. Anyway.
But also that happens.
It does. And then the next story is called I Used to Live Here Once. And it is this lady who is in a familiar place, and there's these two little kids, and she goes up and tries to talk to them. And you basically kind of get the feeling that she's probably a ghost. And it just ends
with, oh,
I used to live here once. And it's really sad, but there's also, I don't know, there's something kind of like almost hopeful about it, that you're at least,
I think, you know, sometimes I wouldn't mind being a ghost. This is something I've never told anyone ever. So you guys are hearing it first.
Tell us.
Well, because you get to hang around.
You do.
Like, you get to, like, I'm not scared of the finite thing. I mean, if I sleep, if there is nothing after and I sleep, that's actually my dream come true. But, like, it would be kind of cool to just, like, watch different generations. Well,
you kind of get this.
There was a.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, there was a horror movie that I think had Elijah Wood in it. It was an indie film, and it was about he dies, but it's very sort of indie film, so he wears a white sheet throughout the whole. But he's with his wife, and she gets married, but then they decide to move house, and it, unlike the sort of creepy horror films, he can't move with them.
Yeah.
And it's his kids, and it's like kind of sad, because... Yeah,
it's kind
of, and he has to stay there and see a new family.
Like I said, it's a really sad story, but for some reason, and it's just, you kind of get this kind of glimmer of hope in it, even though it's very, very sad.
Yeah,
but that's where you get a lot of that kind of stuff from her, and sometimes she was quite funny. There's also a lot of her kind of emphasizing that the things that get discounted just because they're girly or associated with women, she's like, these are actually really meaningful things. So she has a whole section about like what it means to dye your hair and like the kind of thing that happens when you dye your hair. And so she's really, really insightful about a lot of that kind of stuff.
If you could recommend, this is not on my list, but if you could recommend one book as entry, like a gateway drug to genius,
like gateway drug to Reese. Quartet is my favorite of her four. And that's the one that is kind of mirroring her affair with Ford Maddox Ford. It's a good one, though. It's a really good one. And then the last one is called Good Morning Midnight. And that one is a close runner-up for me. So those would be the two that I'd recommend.
We're coming to the end. Do you have any final thoughts on
my dissertation?
I actually really enjoyed going through it again, because ours do mirror, they differ, but they mirror in a lot of ways.
They do mirror in a lot of ways. I think it's so funny, because when I was reading through yours, I also had that feeling. I was like, man, if ever I felt like I was supposed to be friends with this person. Like, aww, we wrote these so long, you know, so far apart, but so much of it is so close. My final thought is for anyone who's going to do a viva or a defense of their dissertation, is that this is literally what happens to you. You start talking about it, and then you just kind of word vomit so much information, because you've spent so much time with your thesis, and you are so wrapped up in it. And like, you know, you were saying earlier, when you were finishing up your book and when I was finishing up my thesis, we both were like, these words are meaningless. This whole thing is terrible. I can't believe what have I written? And I remember thinking that when I was preparing for my Viva, but then I went into it and it was just so easy to talk about. And it was like, I mean, this truly becomes like your little child, that you've birthed and you know inside and out, and you're just like, yeah, I can tell you so many things. So if any of our listeners are going to do this or thinking about it, just know that the Viva is the least scary part, even though they make it seem like the worst part. It's really not bad.
I think on both sides of the pond, it seems to be the least scary part. I mean, it's tough to talk, but you're right. Like, I remember walking into my Viva and my supervisor being like, you're the expert. Mm-hmm. Like, you wrote on this very one specific thing. Yeah. So like they don't know about it.
Yeah, I had all these notes and things because I had to do my Viva on Zoom because it was we were still in the throes of it, and so I had a lot of notes kind of spread out over the table, and I looked at zero of them. Like, nothing that I had pre-prepared was even necessary. I just, both because I already knew everything, but also like the conversation just kind of flows. It doesn't feel like you're being drilled. They're not going to say
that. That's sort of the point of the dissertation, is at the end. And whenever I was examining, I did it Glasgow and Edinburgh. That's what I looked for the most, was really less about the questions and more like kind of what we just did in this time together, which is, can you talk about it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, if you can talk about it.
Like, I think was originally the whole point of it too, like way back when they were invented. It was just because they were like, we want to make sure that you're the actual author here and that you didn't have like a ghostwriter. And that was the entire reason. So it's really, you know, they'll have some questions. I remember some questions about like, why didn't you do this thing? But you have an answer because you probably already thought about it. You know why you didn't do that thing. It's not a...
And if someone says, like, why didn't you use an author? Especially if it's, like, Derrida or... just say...
Difference.
I'll think about that.
Yeah,
you can... I'll think about that later.
You know what I like to tell people is just say, well, you know, I really considered it, but, like, at the end of the day, there just wasn't room to give them enough space. They're, you know... They needed a lot more than I could give them space in this.
That's why footnotes are so important. I remember I was like, because I was so deep in Protestant theology and I was doing Catholic Protestant stuff though. And I was just like, please note that these are Protestant theologians. I would love to tackle Thomas Aquinas and all of these guys. But my life is short and I cannot.
We only have so much time on this.
I was like, please note that I am not sectarian. I just can't read that fast. I can't read that fast. That's it. Well, that's awesome. Well, thanks for sharing.
Yeah, absolutely. I've successfully finished this horrific drink.
Me too. I feel like I might die. But we're going to go now watch The Ultimatum.
We're gonna now cleanse our palates with some amazing reality TV.
I genuinely hope when Stuart walked away, he walked to like Taco Bell or something. I really do.
He was like, I need the strongest flavor in the world.
He just walked away and then just never came back.
He was like, done with this nonsense.
All right. Well, I told him that it wasn't a Negroni, which technically I feel like is true.
It isn't. These are Negronis. We did it correctly.
I know. We did it. I'm not. Oh, I'm going to take an after. Because you saw my before. Yeah. Anyway, guys, we love you very much. I don't know if we said welcome to Theology on the Rocks, but we're here.
It's always possible. Join us next week when we talk about something else and drink something better.
Oh, my gosh. Jean Reese. No wonder you wrote the way you did. Lord, girl, I want to take her on a wine night. She needed a wine night.
Drink something better.
God, get that girl a mimosa. This is too intense. Bye.